This is Morning Edition from NHPR. I'm Rick Gamley. It's time for the New Hampshire News Recap. The U.S. Attorney's Office is seeking to strip a Nashua woman of her citizenship, saying fingerprint records show she is the same person who was supposed to be deported in 2009. The Boston Globe's Stephen Porter joins us now to bring us up to date with the details on this story. Good morning, Stephen.
Good morning.
Well, Stephen, bring us up to date on this case.
The U.S. Attorney's Office in New Hampshire has filed a lawsuit against a Nashua woman, Kandakar Nazmunesa Ola. She is a native of Bangladesh who came to the United States in 1994. She was a married mother of two at that time. She went on to have two more kids in the United States. She's living in Nashua. Her family owns a convenience store, and she's been in the United States for more than 30 years, including the past 17 as a U.S. citizen. The U.S. Attorney's Office in New Hampshire is now trying to revoke her U.S. citizenship, alleging that she concealed material information intentionally when she applied for naturalization in 2007. Basically, the government is saying that she had been ordered deported under a different name before she secured lawful permanent residency in the United States. And so subsequent proceedings, she didn't mention that. She left that out, allegedly. And so because of that, the government now alleges that she should have her U.S. citizenship revoked.
This seems to be the first denaturalization case filed here in New Hampshire. How is this linked to the Trump administration's crackdown on immigration and specifically foreign-born citizens?
So the Trump administration has been establishing as a priority an effort to pursue denaturalization cases against U.S. citizens who were born elsewhere, who came to the United States and obtained U.S. citizenship, swore allegiance to the United States. The Trump administration has embarked on an effort to pursue denaturalization cases more aggressively than they have been pursued in the past. These are cases that allege a naturalized citizen, maybe engaged in some sort of fraudulent behavior in order to obtain U.S. citizenship. So we have been seeing about one case per month historically. The Trump administration has made very clear that it intends to ramp up the number of such cases being filed. And there are signs that that ramp up began in May. This was documented by records reviewed by the Transactional Records Access Clearinghouse. And that uptick showed that so far in 2026, the government had filed nearly 40 such cases. And that was just as of mid-June, so we still had half of a year to go. And those 40 cases were more than twice as many denaturalization lawsuits as we had seen in any full calendar year over the past two decades.
So these denaturalizations are being prioritized by the administration's own admission here. What standard is being used for prosecution?
The Justice Department released a memo last summer that outlined the government's priorities with regard to which denaturalization cases the Justice Department would pursue. One of the many factors mentioned in that memo was that the government would pursue cases deemed sufficiently important, and advocates were concerned about the broad and subjective nature of that standard. They warned of potential political weaponization. And it's not entirely clear what the outer limits of those priorities might entail.
Now, Stephen, looking at this case, I mean, it appears to be straightforward. You lie in your naturalization process and you're out. I mean, what's the pushback from immigration advocates about this?
So I spoke with the defendant's attorney in this case, and he offered a fairly restrained comment, which was that he would look at the facts in this case and he would look at the law in this case and make an argument that is to make the strongest argument possible on behalf of his client. And so it's possible that this is a straightforward case. We have seen similar cases in New Hampshire in the past. They're rare, but we did see one that was finalized in 2020, and that is mentioned in my story. So it's possible that the government has a clear-cut case here, but the context is interesting. Given the fact that the Trump administration is aggressively pursuing denaturalization cases, the realities on the ground are catching people's attention a bit more than perhaps they would in the past.
So we can expect to see more of these types of cases, I imagine. And even if subsequently no crime has been committed by these naturalized citizens, the Trump administration intends to pursue them.
That's right. Assistant Attorney General Brett Shumate had a quote that he released in a statement saying that under the Trump administration, if you defrauded the denaturalization process, you will face the full force of the Justice Department, he said in that statement. And he added that the Justice Department has only scratched the surface and that many more complaints are coming. One thing that's interesting to note is that the Justice Department is really highlighting certain cases that involve allegations of heinous crimes. So they're you know, highlighting examples of people who have been accused of all kinds of heinous crimes, from murder to sexual crimes and things of that nature. This case that I covered in New Hampshire is not mentioned in those kind of high-profile cases that the Justice Department has highlighted. But this case in New Hampshire is still happening. So there's an interesting dynamic between kind of the highest level rhetoric and also what's happening on the ground. So I think that we should be kind of watching to see the full breadth of how these cases unfold moving forward.
The Boston Globe's Stephen Porter. Stephen, thanks so much for the time.
Thank you. Appreciate it.
This is the New Hampshire News Recap from NHPR. I'm Rick Gamley. The state's Department of Education surveyed New Hampshire teachers recently, asking, what are you seeing a year after the statewide bell-to-bell cell phone ban at schools? NHPR reporter Kate Dario is here to tell us a little bit more about the results of that survey. Good morning, Kate.
Morning, Rick.
So tell us, what are the results of this survey?
So this survey showed that teachers and administrators are feeling like this ban is pretty effective at reducing disruptions in the classroom. Nearly 80% of teachers said that they noticed fewer distractions this academic year compared to last year without as many cell phones in the classroom. Also, a third of teachers said that it led to fewer disciplinary problems, too.
Okay, so this is an impact beyond the classroom itself?
Because it's bell to bell, it means that students can't pull out their phones during lunch. So people were saying you're hearing kids talk more with each other in the hallways. You're seeing kids pull out cards at lunch and playing cards with each other as opposed to just, you know, scrolling on their phone. About half of teachers and administrators surveyed reported that students had developed better social skills and were forming deeper relationships with each other since the ban began. And a lot of them said that also they noticed improvements in class discussions, that students were more engaged, and that also on certain projects, they would, you know, use more analog tools like a point-and-shoot camera instead of a smartphone. So a lot of people are feeling really excited about this.
I happen to have a daughter in high school, and, you know, she doesn't have to give up her phone at the door in the morning, but she has to keep it put away, I know. Are some schools, you know, taking the phone in the morning and giving it back in the afternoon, or are they just telling them to keep it in their backpacks? How does it work?
Most schools are doing the same thing that it sounds like your daughter's school is doing, which is basically an out-of-sight, out-of-mind policy. So students can keep their phones on them, but they're just not allowed to pull it out, you know, during class or during lunch or walking through the hallways. Some places have invested in things like pouches to, you know, put their phones away, and the majority are letting kids keep their phones. They just don't want to see it during the day.
I imagine it's a little easier than having to collect them and put them in pause or something like that.
Yeah, exactly.
So this is not unique to New Hampshire. I know there's been other initiatives around the country. What are other school districts reporting?
Yeah, so New Hampshire is one of 22 states and also DC that has a bell-to-bell policy in place now. What's unique about New Hampshire is that part of the law dictates an annual assessment each year that will allow the state and also the individual districts to sort of adjust what the policy actually looks like depending on what they've seen. Some of the educators that I spoke with said that they feel like kind of the next frontier in the classroom is figuring out how to deal with other screens like iPads or Chromebooks, which some of them said are kind of replacing cell phones as like the screen distraction in the classroom. So I think they're feeling encouraged by the results of this bell-to-bell policy and are excited about what it might look like in the future if there's fewer devices in the classroom in general.
Well, finally, Kate, I got to ask you this. How do students feel about the ban?
Yeah, I mean, I didn't get the chance to speak to any students directly, but what teachers have said and what the survey reflected is that kids are feeling great. You know, again, I think that it's really a new opportunity to sort of be really present with their peers and in the classroom. And it sounds like a lot of kids are feeling more engaged and excited to be at school, which is great.
NHPR's Kate Dario. Kate, thank you.
Thanks, Rick.
This is the New Hampshire News Recap. I'm Rick Gamley. We're recapping some stories from the past week. There have been more shark sightings off the New England coast this week. Amanda Bieland, a senior producer at WBUR in Boston, has been reporting on this, and she joins us now to tell us a little bit more. Amanda, there have been several sightings of species of shark that aren't typically seen in our waters. What's going on?
Yeah, so we are seeing more sightings of three different types of sharks lately: spinner, tiger, and smooth hammerhead sharks. And these aren't new species, but these are not regular species that we see here. Sightings of these three species have become more regular and more frequent, which makes scientists think that they are spending more time here off the coast of New England in the summer. I spoke with Dr. Ryan Noddick. He's a research scientist with the Anderson Cabot Center for Ocean Life at the New England Aquarium, and he says it's likely climate change. Now, we know ocean temps in the North Atlantic are some of the highest ever recorded, and there's data from 2019 from Climate Central that showed that New England waters were sort of warming more than anywhere else in the country. And these sharks are more susceptible to climate change because they are cold-blooded, also called ectothermic. Basically, that means they can't regulate their own body temperature. But because of warming waters, where they can go in sort of that range to keep in that optimal temperature is moving up north.
So as the water is warming, I mean, these sharks just can survive farther north. I mean, even just a degree of change, I read, you know, makes this possible.
I can't tell the difference between 73 and 74 degrees, but for a shark, it's really impactful. Dr. Noddick says that a change of 1 degree for sort of a prolonged period of time can impact a shark tenfold. That's not to say, he says, sharks can't move into colder or hotter sort of outside that optimal range of temperature, but it's just spending a prolonged period of time is really what the problem is.
So as we look for these sharks, where's the best place to possibly spot them off the New England coast?
So for tiger and smooth hammerheads, Dr. Noddick has said that they've been spotted off the coast of the Cape, Nantucket, and the Vineyard. There was actually a report earlier this month of a pair of brothers catching a tiger shark on the Cape. And last year there was, you know, sort of reports around Buzzards Bay of some hammerheads. If you're looking for spinners, that's more sort of the southern New England area. So that is Nantucket and Martha's Vineyard as well, but maybe a little bit further on the coast, maybe into Rhode Island and Connecticut as well. If you're fishing off the coast, you have a chance of catching one or running into one, says Dr. Noddick. But he says it's not like you're going to go to the beach and sort of see them close to the coastline in that way. You know, if you do, you'll have a lot of luck playing the lottery, he says.
And I mean, these sharks are not specifically hunting humans, of course, but there are still things you need to do if you're in the water around them to stay safe. You know, what should we be doing?
If you're near salty water, you have the potential of interacting with a shark in some way. But there are some things that you can do to sort of limit the interaction. Maybe avoid swimming at dusk or dawn, which is their feeding times. Maybe take off the flashy or shiny jewelry or clothing. Avoid lots of splashing and maybe swim in groups. And I think his biggest advice was sort of be aware of your surroundings. You know, if you see a seal, maybe don't swim near that seal. That's a main source of food for sharks. And don't swim near sort of bait balls if you see them in the water as well.
Okay. Well, we'll be watching out for sharks and probably have the theme to Jaws in our heads when we go to the beach. But there's some good tips there. Thanks, Amanda.
Of course. Thanks, Rick.
Amanda Bieland is a senior producer at WBUR in Boston. If you missed part of today's segment or if you want to catch up on previous weeks, you can find the New Hampshire News Recap wherever you happen to listen to podcasts. I'm Rick Ganley, and this is NHPR.